Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is December 14th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. We have a special episode for you today, in which Angela Meaden will be interviewing Claire Lee of CERN. Let's get straight into the interview.
Joining us tonight is Claire Lee. She is a particle physicist at CERN, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's right. I'm with the University of Johannesburg, but I'm based here at CERN.
Cool. It's great to have you back with us, Claire. We interviewed you a couple of months ago. I don't know if our listeners remember the faster-than-light neutrino interview.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. Thank you.
So you're officially the first repeat interview we have.
Oh, awesome. I feel honored.
Right, so let's get straight to the meat of it. You're here to talk to us about CERN's announcement yesterday. Can you tell us, please, in layman's terms, what did CERN announce yesterday?
Okay, so it was a very, very exciting announcement from a particle physics point of view, although I think a lot of people in the public are kind of standing back and saying, well, what does this actually mean? So the announcement was about the Higgs boson, which is the particle theorized to give mass to everything in the universe. In particle physics, we have something called the Standard Model, which is a very, very excellent explanation of how everything in the universe fits together. It explains all the basic particles. But unfortunately, the simplest version of the theory has all the masses of the particles equal to zero, which is obviously not a good thing because I have mass, you know, my cat has mass, everything has mass. So we need something extra that is supposed to give mass to everything, in the, to all the particles. And that was this Higgs boson that was hypothesized. Actually, it's the Higgs field, and then a result of the Higgs field is a particle called the Higgs boson. So at CERN, they built this large Hadron Collider, and two of the experiments, ATLAS and CMS, one of their primary goals was to look for evidence of this Higgs boson. ATLAS and CMS are two separate experiments, two separate detectors, almost on opposite sides of the LHC ring, but we've been running together, gathering data at the same time, so we have roughly the same amount of data for both ATLAS and CMS. So yesterday, what was announced was the Higgs results from ATLAS and CMS, where it turns out that both experiments are seeing a slight excess of events in the low mass region, so around 124, 125 GeV Higgs mass. And this is a slight excess compared to what you would expect if there was no Higgs at all. So the excitement is, is this now a real Higgs, or is it just a background fluctuation?
So what you're telling us is maybe we found something, but maybe we didn't.
Yes.
That seems a bit ironic that it was so exciting, and then we're like, well, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, it's strange. You know, I mean, looking for the Higgs is kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack. Only when you really get down to it, you kind of need to look for about 20 needles in a couple of haystacks rather than just one.
Yeah.
Because if you find one needle, you can't really be sure if that is really a true needle or if maybe it's a piece of hay that looks a lot like a needle.
Yes.
So it's kind of the same with particle physics. We can't just find one event that we think looks like a Higgs, and then say it is a Higgs. One of the main reasons because of this is because we don't actually know what mass the Higgs has. So we have to see a bunch of events, all that look a lot like a Higgs, and they all have to be around about the same mass for us to start saying something is interesting.
All right.
And then once you get more technical, then you start talking about significances and 3 sigma or 5 sigma.
All right, we'll go into that a little bit more in detail later. What I'd first like to ask you, you've mentioned earlier about the Higgs field and then the Higgs particle itself, which the two interact and impart mass, if I'm not mistaken, with they interact with other particles.
Yes.
Can you give us just a description of, maybe in a bit more detail if you can, of what the Higgs field is, if we know, and how it interacts with other particles?
Sure, absolutely. I think the best way to do it is with an analogy. There's lots of very nice analogies around out there. One of my favorites, though, is one used by John Ellis. So let's imagine that you are on a mountain covered in snow, which is quite appropriate for being in the Northern Hemisphere right now.
Yep.
So you're looking at a lovely snowfield, and suddenly a skier zips past you going very, very quickly over the snow on his skis. Now, the skier goes quite fast because he's on skis that are quite small, and the important fact is the skis interact very little with the snowfield. So he doesn't get a lot of drag from the snow on his skis, which means he goes very fast.
Okay.
Now, think of somebody walking through a lot of snow. That person sinks quite deep into the snow. He really experiences a lot of drag on him, between himself and the snowfield. So as he walks, he's going much, much slower through the snowfield. He feels a lot of drag on him. That's kind of the way that the Higgs field works to give mass to particles. The more a particle interacts with the Higgs field, the more drag, you can say, that particle feels, and that drag manifests itself as mass.
Okay.
So the more a particle interacts with the Higgs field, the heavier that particle's mass is. And the less it interacts, the lighter the mass of the particle.
And the faster it would move.
And the faster exactly that it could move.
So if we didn't have the Higgs field or something similar to it that was imparting mass, we'd have all these particles zipping around like crazy, and that would obviously have some serious impact a serious impact on how matter forms.
Exactly. Everything would be massless. And I mean, we're obviously not massless. I wish I was massless, especially after Christmas, but fortunately that doesn't happen. So then the way to go from thinking about the field to thinking about the particle is, if you imagine a snowfield is made up of a whole lot of little snowflakes. And in the same way, the Higgs field is made up of a whole lot of little particles called the Higgs boson.
Okay.
In particle physics, we like to think of things in terms of particles. And then in quantum field theory, people think in terms of fields. So that's sort of how experimentalists and theorists collide.
Which is a good segue to my next question. So at the LHC, we have this gigantic ring that accelerates these particles towards each other, and they collide, and there's spectacular things that happen. Can you give us a little bit of background on what's happening in that machine and what you guys are looking for after those collisions?
Sure, absolutely. So the LHC's main running is on protons. So they start off with some hydrogen gas, and as you know, is a proton with an electron, and they use a magnetic field to strip the electrons off the hydrogen, so you're just left with protons.
Okay.
They then channel these protons through a couple of pre-accelerators, you can almost say, before the LHC, and each one both bumps up their energy and their speed a bit more. So by the time they actually enter the LHC machine itself, they already have an energy of 450 GeV each.
Okay.
That's 450 giga electron volts. So what they do is they send these protons in bunches into the LHC until they've got bunches circulating all the way around the LHC, but in both directions. Then they start to ramp up the energy. There are these radio frequency cavities all the way around the machine, interspersed around the machine. And each time a proton moves through one of these, its energy increases. It basically accelerates as if you have a proton going, you know, towards a negative electron. Just by the electromagnetic force, that proton gets pulled along and accelerated a bit. At the same time, the LHC magnets are increasing their magnetic field, because the faster something goes, the stronger you have to turn it to keep it going around in the same radius.
Yes.
So that happens, and what's currently happening is that takes those protons from an energy of 450 GeV to 3,500 GeV, or 3.5 tera electron volts. So we have protons going around the LHC in both directions. Each of them have an energy of 3.5 tera electron volts. And at four different places around the LHC ring, Atlas and CMS being two of them, the LHC team forces those beams to cross. And they tune it so that at the same time the beams cross, the bunches of protons cross at the same time. So you have two bunches of protons colliding. When those bunches of protons collide, you get protons, the individual protons inside them collide as well. Most of the time you get sort of a glancing collision, which doesn't really give us interesting physics events, but about once per bunch crossing, you get protons that collide nicely head on. And then you basically add up the two energy, the protons. So 3.5 plus 3.5 gives a center of mass energy of 7 tera electron volts. Okay. It's like if two cars are driving at each other at 120 kilometers an hour, they collide at 240 kilometers an hour with respect to the other car.
And obviously, if it's just a glancing blow, then less of the energy goes into that direct collision and is used to carry the particles off in other directions.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the less energy you have for the collision, well, if you're looking for really heavy particles, you need lots of energy.
Yeah.
So the interesting particles we look for are the ones that we need a lot out of energy to create, you know, a lot of energy in the collision.
Okay. So from this, you've had all of these, I don't know, how many results were these findings based on that were announced yesterday?
Okay.
If that makes any sense, sorry, how many collision events did you guys have to use as your body of knowledge for this?
So if you actually wanted to count collisions, Atlas has recorded about 350 trillion collisions. But with a number that big, that really doesn't mean a lot.
Yeah.
Just talking about a pure number. What we do is we talk in terms of integrated luminosity. So basically, the luminosity is how much data that you've collected during the course of the run. So throughout this year alone, Atlas has recorded 4.9 inverse femtobarns of data.
An inverse femtobarn is a measure of area.
Yes.
We discussed this on the podcast a couple of episodes ago, and it took us about 2 days to wrap our heads around what this thing is, and it's just area.
Okay, let's say it like this. When the LHC started running at the beginning of this year, people were saying, if we got one inverse femtobarn by summer, that would be great. If we got two inverse femtobarns by the end of the year, maybe three, that would be unbelievable. And we ended the year with almost five inverse femtobarns of data, which was brilliant and way exceeded the expectations for the 2011 run.
Well, that's fantastic.
So in terms of what was expected, the LHC team did fantastically well and gave us, you know, everything was just more than was expected, which is brilliant for the physics results.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we've got is, from all of this, we may have seen something that looks like it's the Higgs boson.
Yes.
And they draw this conclusion because there's a spike of the particles that are released by the collision at about 125, it's the electron volts.
Yes, giga.
Yeah, so at about 125 giga electron volts. Why is that mass significant as opposed to a higher mass or a lower mass? One thing they were talking about is how they had ruled out these other masses. So why is 125 important?
It's important for a number of reasons. So the standard model Higgs mass Yes. Was sort of somewhere in the middle. Okay, let me start again. There are theories that say we might not just have one Higgs, we could have a couple of different Higgses. So particles that look, that are like a Higgs, but somewhat different. And those come from theories like supersymmetry.
Yeah.
So first of all, we talk about the standard model Higgs. The standard model Higgs is one Higgs that goes into the standard model that solves the mass problem of the standard model. That's very, very nice. But it's not that interesting theoretically, because that would mean that there's no such thing as supersymmetry. And as you may know, string theory relies a lot on supersymmetry. So in terms of breaking ground and finding new physics, just a plain standard model Higgs is not too great. So the standard model Higgs is sort of in the mid-mass region, maybe about 130 GeV up to 200 GeV, something like that. What's interesting with a 125 GeV Higgs, 126 GeV Higgs, is that it's a very, very nice region for experimentalists because it means it's quite accessible for us to use the LHC to look for Higgs in that region, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
If the mass was higher, then it's possible that we could run for years, but the LHC just still wouldn't have enough energy to produce enough Higgs for us to say anything, you know, for us to claim a discovery. So 126 GeV is quite a convenient region for a Higgs to be at because it means that with the LHC we can hopefully make a discovery if we see enough events.
Okay, excellent.
And another interesting thing about the low mass region is that around 120 GeV Higgs mass. Down here, the Higgs is not necessarily stable with the plain old theory, and that's due to the top quark. The top quark has these radiative corrections which collapse the Higgs potential, if that even made sense.
Well, I read a little bit about corrections, but I must confess it's way beyond my physics understanding.
Okay. Well, suffice it to say, let's just say that down in the low mass region, the Higgs may not be perfectly stable. So some new physics would be needed to make the Higgs stable. So if we see a low mass Higgs, that could be an indication of some physics beyond the standard model, something new and exciting.
Okay, and at 125, would that be considered a low mass? You said earlier 130 up. So would this be considered low?
It's sort of on a very broad border. So we're not quite sure yet. We have to figure out if it is a Higgs.
Of course.
And then if it is, then, you know, there's other checks that would need to be done to figure out whether or not this is a plain old standard model Higgs or not.
Okay.
It's in the lowish mass region enough for it to be interesting.
Can you tell us, Claire, the giga electron volt is, why is it used as a unit of mass when the electron volt is a measure of energy?
Yes. So in particle physics, what people often do to make units nice is you set constants equal to 1. So one of those constants, you set the speed of light c equal to 1.
Yeah.
So in actual fact, when we're talking about a proton having 350 GeV, or a Higgs mass, for example, of 126 GeV, what we actually are saying is 126 GeV over c.
Okay.
In commonplace, we make C equal to 1, so we just talk about GeV.
Okay.
So really, it is GeV over C.
So it's one of those messy areas of physics where energy and mass are almost intertwined, almost considered the same thing.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Another question I have is, are there any likely properties of the Higgs boson, other than its mass, that could be inferred from the results so far if this is a Higgs?
That's an interesting question, because I have to think quite carefully about the answer.
Yeah, that's what happens when you have physics teachers who submit questions.
Yes. If this is a Higgs, okay, now this is my sort of personal interpretation here. If this is a Higgs, one of the things that we would need to obviously see is if this is a standard model Higgs or if this could be a supersymmetry Higgs or something else interesting like that. One of the ways in which you could do that is you could work out the cross-section, which is basically the number of Higgses you would expect given your conditions. You could work that out for what the standard model Higgs would give you. So if you've got a nice Higgs bump at 126 GeV, what you could do is you could take your standard model Higgs theory and you could work out how many you would expect to see in your plot. And you could compare what you would expect to see to what you have. And if it is a standard model Higgs, then those two numbers should coincide. If you see something, if the peak that you see is a lot less, or maybe even a lot more than what the standard model Higgs suggests, then it could be an indication that you've got something new going on there. So it's not just a standard model Higgs.
Okay.
So that's one of the things, I guess, that you can do. Obviously, as well, you know, then there's all sorts of properties that you can measure from the Higgs. You know, the width of the peak, the width gives you an indication of the decay time of the Higgs. So you can learn a lot of things just by looking at the peak.
Claire, earlier you touched on the sigma concept to us. Could you describe that to us a little bit and tell us what makes a difference between something being 2 sigma or 5 sigma?
Okay. So sigma is a statistical way of saying how likely it is for something to happen. Where the sigma comes in, you know, in an experimental point of view is, let's imagine you have a background, and you plot all your points along that background, and then you have a point, that is above the background. Now, each of your points have error bars, which are hopefully not big, and a rough way of thinking about sigma is how many error bar sizes away from the background your interesting point is. So if you've got a point that is very close to the background, maybe there's only like a difference of one error bar in between your point and the background, then you would say that's a 1 sigma event. But if your error bars, if you've got a point that is maybe 5 error bars away from the background, or 5 sizes of your error bar away from the background, then you would call that 5 sigma. So 5 sigma is obviously better than 1 sigma because for something to get way up there, it means, it's more likely really out there rather than just a statistical fluctuation.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's like a measurement of, sort of a measurement of your certainty of the statistical significance of what you've seen. So like with the speed of light where they had an error bar of, 64 nanoseconds.
I don't know what the error bar actually was for the neutrinos.
I think they said they expected something like 64 second, a variation of 64 seconds, and then the one they found fell just outside of that.
Yeah.
So it was just outside of the error bars. But what we got yesterday from CERN was that the results show a sigma of around about 2 sigma.
Yes.
So I think the Atlas was a little bit above, and the other experiment, I forget the name, CMS, was just a little bit below 2 sigma.
Yeah. So Atlas, okay, so then you get the difference between local and global significance, which I'll also mention now. In Atlas, the Atlas quoted a global significance of 2.3 sigma, and CMS as 1.9 sigma. So another way of thinking about, of thinking about sigma is how often these events would happen. The less often it happens, the higher the sigma. So the higher the sigma, the more unlikely your occurrence is. So for something like 5 sigma, I think 5 sigma corresponds to something like a 270 in 1 billion chance.
Sure.
Of seeing something. So in particle physics, what we are aiming for is we are aiming for our number to be 5 sigma. Because when our number is 5 sigma, that means that, you know, it's very, very likely then that we can say this actually is a Higgs.
Okay.
So right now we're sitting at 2.3 sigma, 1.9 sigma. It's not yet enough to actually say whether or not this is a Higgs. Physics has had results that are 2.3 sigma, up to 3 sigma, 3.5 sigma, that when running over more data, those have actually gone away. They were just some background fluctuations.
Okay.
So while this is very exciting because it's giving us hints that there's possibly something there, it's still not yet enough that we can actually say anything for definite.
So what we need to do is smash a whole lot more protons together over the next couple of years and get that just volume of data in so you can see, is this more common or less common?
Yes. If the LHC performs just as well as it did this year, next year, then we should definitely have enough data to be able to say for definite whether there is a Higgs or not.
Okay. So I'm holding my breath.
Well, I mean, so that's only like end of next year.
Yes, of course.
So
of course.
Maybe 3.
Cool. So, Claire, is there anything that we can say we know for sure from these results, or is it still very, well, it maybe not?
We can absolutely say for sure that we don't know anything for sure.
Brilliant. That's a fantastic place to start.
Maybe a little less for sure is that we can say that we, to 95% confidence, we know the Higgs doesn't have a mass between 100 and like 27 GeV to 600 GeV.
Okay. Which is an important finding in itself. It might not have the wow factor of a discovery of the Higgs, but it's just as important to rule out the possibility, the non-possibilities.
Absolutely, because now that we know where not to look, it means that we can maybe tune our analysis to be more focused on this low-mass region, possibly giving us better results or higher, more efficient results in the low-mass region. That doesn't mean we're not going to stop looking in the higher-mass region, because this is the standard model Higgs that has been ruled out.
Yes.
And if we start to see something coming up in this region that we've ruled out the standard model Higgs, then it could mean that maybe it's something new, some new physics that we haven't thought of.
It could also point towards the theory of supersymmetry.
Exactly.
That says that there should be a lower mass Higgs and a higher mass Higgs as well. Or I forget the term for it, it's the fermion as opposed to the boson.
Yes. Some supersymmetry theories have up to 5 Higgs bosons or
wow.
Higgs particles that we could look for.
Jeez, that would keep you busy.
Yes. Okay, so one of the things that you might have heard come up in these talks when people are quoting results is this look elsewhere effect. So the problem with looking for a particle that we don't know the mass of is we're basically looking for something, but we're not sure where it could be. So if we start to see a fluctuation or some peak in our spectrum, in our mass spectrum, the local significance is what that is what I described before, the number of error bars away, basically, mm-hmm. From the background. But unfortunately, it's not just as simple as that. You also have to take into account and calculate the probability of that fluctuation happening at every other point. So this is why it's called the look elsewhere effect. How likely is it that this fluctuation could have happened elsewhere? And when you do that, that reduces, because we don't have an idea of where the mass should be, the look elsewhere effect reduces our significance down slightly. So, for example, in ATLAS, we go a 2.4 sigma local significance, and then when we take into account this look elsewhere effect, it drops down to about 2.3 sigma.
Okay.
Yeah. So that it's just another thing that we have to bear in mind is if you don't know what you're looking for and where you're looking, then if you see some, you know, if you see a fluctuation, you have to also bear in mind, you know, how likely it was that that fluctuation could happen anywhere else.
Well, that's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-host, to our guest, and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
You have been listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. Theme music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.